Meet Sven. He's very excited right now. Sven doesn't play poker, but he's still very excited. You see, Sven is a dealer for Porsche, and he's just found out that PokerStars players earn $7.5 million in VIP points every month. And with our all-inclusive program, that's enough to redeem 5 of the lovely pieces of German engineering every day. Keep Sven happy. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out why our rewards program seems to leave other schemes, well, out of commission. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Annie Up PokerCast presented by PokerStars. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's August 7th, 2009, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I am Scott Long, and I am ready to cruise, Chris.
We were sailing along on the Moonlight Bay.
You sound like a gopher up on the Lido deck there.
Gopher. Hey, I have no plans to eye any seats in the Senate or the House of Representatives.
Okay, that's good to know. That's good to know. But yeah, it's been a major crazy week here at Annie Up headquarters as we got all the prep work done for the Annie Up cruise, which is less than 2 weeks away now.
I'm scared.
142 people sailing with us as of right now.
Wow.
A lot of people.
I thought we were going to be just unbelievable at like 40. We're like, this is great. Now it's 100 more than that.
We have, and I'm not lying here, Chris, 1 ton of poker supplies packed up between your SUV and my dad's pickup truck. 1 ton, 14,000 chips, 10 tables, all kinds of other stuff.
My back is still hurting from carrying all that crap.
Yeah. We really need to learn to invest in two guys in a truck or something like that, because us two guys in our trucks just don't really cut it.
Seven brothers helping others. That's what we need to do. We need to hire those guys.
All that's left to do is pack our Speedos, and I'm just trying to decide between the red and the blue.
Blue is definitely your color, plus you're liberal. So
that's true. That's
true.
I don't
want you wearing red. But, I'm going to go with the basketball shorts and the never-removing T-shirt, because no one is going to see this ugly. People are going to think I'm a beached whale and try to push me overboard, so I'm not taking anything off when I'm on the ship.
That's a very good suggestion, Chris, and I might follow you on that, because recently I went out in the sun a little bit and lathered up with the sunscreen. Uh-huh. And forgot to put the sunscreen in the old belly button. And I'm an innie, not an outie. And I swear for a week after that, I thought that I had some kind of internal bleeding because the belly button was red. Until I realized, no, that's just the sun reminding me, hey, cover all 2,000 of your parts next time.
So much for us keeping the first item quick on the show.
All right, well, if you folks can't make it on, and there's still time to book, but I heard it's outrageously priced now, so you might want to skip. But keep March 18th to 22nd free on your calendar, because that may very well be the Annie Poker Cruise 2.
Combined with Scott's birthday bash.
All right, it's my birthday, so you can come and buy me cake and shots and all kinds of other stuff.
Shots of Johnny Walker Gold or whatever the hell that great stuff is.
You don't shoot Johnny Walker Gold, Chris, please.
Oh, you sip. Don't? I'm sorry.
Sip it.
You sip it. Okay. I don't know. I have no idea.
And if you can't cruise, then at least show up Wednesday night at 9 p.m. for the next installment of everybody's favorite tournament series, Apes.
Apes.
As always, on PokerStars.com. Go ahead and tell them what the game is, Chris.
Well, you know, it's going to be a no-limit hold'em tournament with rebuys, $1 plus 10 cents. And as Scott put here on our little note field, wild, wild, wacky stuff expected. The password is anti-up, all one word. You guys know what to do. But if you don't, go to antiupmagazine.com/AIPS. and you'll get all the details there. And you know, I'm not expecting a wild night, Scott. I'm expecting to go out pretty early, and then we'll kick back and watch a little of That 70s Show.
Yeah, well, don't you forget to take your teeth out there, Chris. The rest of us are going to be rebuying all night and partying like Mike Mattisow. So,
but you know, I don't know. Maybe I will rebuy, but I wouldn't count on it. So, everybody, shove at my table.
I cannot believe that you're not going to rebuy. It's $1.
Well, considering I have 3 cents online right now, it's going to be kind of tough. It'll be like, do you want to rebuy? I'll be like, sure. And then it'll say, well, you owe us money. Last thing you want is someone, you know, being the VIG on you for an online tournament. So, I don't know. We'll see if I put some money on there beforehand, but I'm not sure if I can. So.
All right. Well, we'll see everybody Wednesday night at 9 p.m. on PokerStars.com. And, you know, Chris, it's great when we have folks that communicate with the show, and every once in a while they have something new going on, they let us know.
Yeah.
And one of those folks is poker book author Mitchell Kogert. Did I get it right this time?
I don't know if it's Kogert or Kogert. I look at it like yogurt. I don't know. But either way, he knows that we love him.
Yes, he's written a lot of great books, and now... He sent us a link to his one of his websites, therazchallenge.blogspot.com, and he even asked that you say it, not me, because he knew I'd screw it up.
Well, why didn't you tell me that?
Because I just made that up now to cover my tracks. Therazchallenge.blogspot.com, and what he's written there is, what he orders is to say, hey, if Phil Ivey isn't going to write a poker book, and he's right. It doesn't sound like Phil Ivey's going to write a poker book or
right.
even talk to anybody about poker. Mitchell said he's going to analyze Phil Ivey's hands at the World Series of Poker, and that's exactly what he did. He went back and looked at some of the hands leading up to the great one making the final table of this year's World Series, and the little analysts on it.
You're just killing the English language. Oh, my God.
Woo! Boy, give me another shot of Johnny Walker Gold.
Who was the wise one who said, let's let Scott do a lot of the reading on the show? I'm not sure who it was who said that, but yeah, we may have to rethink that, that strategy.
But, you know, it's even more interesting because literally the day after Mitchell emailed us, I got in the mail a copy of a new book called Winning Poker Tournament Strategies. It's by Stephen Rowe. He's a Floridian down here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I flipped through the books, as I always do when I get books in the mail. And very early on in this book, what he does is analyze Gus Hansen's hands, you know, from that book that he wrote.
Yeah.
That Vassar reviewed and loved it, where he, you know, he detailed every single hand on his way to a big tournament win.
Right.
So Steven went back and analyzed and extrapolated and put all that information together and re-explained it in a different way. So what I'm seeing here is kind of a new trend, I think, Chris, of people kind of like recalibrating all the information of that's already out there and presenting it in a different way so people can learn differently from it.
So I'm gonna recalibrate Super System.
There you go.
It'll be called Not So Super System.
I'll call it Simple System.
Simple System.
Get it down to 20 pages.
How to win $20 in your nickel dime home game.
There you go. Perfect. but, you know, I've also been reading this, I think it's a Bill Boston book or Bob Boston or some guy from Boston. That's did an Omaha high-low book, and it's essentially just using Wilson's turbo strategy stuff. And so, you know, there might be something there where people, there really might be some more poker books that haven't been written that should be written.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, do they need to get, like, permission from... I guess you don't need permission, like, from Phil Ivey to write a book about Phil Ivey's play. I mean, you know, there's that Kill Phil book, you know, I guess so.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Pretty good. Well, you know, Scott, I think that I'm going to let you try to tackle the news desk today, but good luck pronouncing the company name in the first item. Have
thanks,
fun.
Buddy, for
Have
the, fun. thanks, buddy, for the little the salad there before I jump out on the news desk.
Go ahead.
All right, the struggling World Poker Tour Enterprises managed to squeak out consecutive profitable quarters, making $370,000 in the second quarter of 2009, and then announced that many of its assets will be bought by Gamnya Limited. for just more than $9 million, pending shareholder approval. That comes from Poker News Daily, who did not provide a pronunciation guide for Gamnia Limited.
You know, before the show, I literally typed in the title of the company and then pronounced pronouncer, all these things, just to see if it would come up, and not one person thought of, hey, you think somebody might be reading this on the air?
You know, I don't know. Why can't they come up with just anti-up?
I know.
It's easy to say. You know, why are they going to go out and come up with this stuff that's impossible?
Exactly. I mean, I guess I'm going to pronounce it Gaminya, like is the Gaminya.
Okay.
But,
very good.
You know, what we'll do is we'll post links to all these stuff and then let people decide on their own how to say it.
All right, moving on. The National Poker Week yielded success in Washington, D.C. as the number of co-sponsors to U.S. Rep. Barney Frank's bill to regulate online poker has grown to 51. And even more importantly, Senator Robert Menendez has introduced a companion bill to Frank's legislation in the Senate.
Is it just me, or does it feel like this is moving way too slow? I mean, I realize the National Poker Week had to happen first, but doesn't it feel like we've been hearing stuff about the bills and sponsored? And I mean, when are they going to put it to the floor and let's do it, man?
Well, they got to line up. They got to get all their little
ducks in
quacks in
a
row.
Yeah.
And so, you know, can't just you could just push it through and then it's going to fail. Why do that? You know,
got to get all their deuces in a row.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Well, it just feels like that.
Oh, well, yeah, 51 co-sponsors now. That's some sort of percentage of the overall number of people at the House, right?
It's definitely good. There's definitely improvement there. I'm so anxious, I guess, eager.
Yes, you are anxious.
All right.
Trust me, I work with you. All right, and finally, ESPN this week debuted a new web-only television show called ESPN Inside Deal, which takes viewers behind the scenes of the poker lifestyle. And also the previously mentioned Face the Ace show debuted on NBC.
Hey, I watched it. Did you watch
it? Yes. I did not watch it, and I'm glad you did, because we've had a lot of people ask us whether we had watched it, and of course they should know. I did not watch poker on TV. And
you have
never not watched a poker show on TV.
Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. It's just a real one very long Full Tilt Poker infomercial, and the people – the problem with this is – that they don't get to screen the people who are playing against the pros, you know. So like the first guy who was on was just like unbelievably scary and had no like television qualities whatsoever. But the second guy was still like, he was such an average Joe, but he was hilarious. He's living in his basement of his house while his mom and his sister and her two kids live upstairs. And they, like, control the house. And he's like, if I win $1 million, I'm throwing them out, and I'm going to buy them a condo. And then it turns out, Scott, he beats Eric Lindgren, and then he beats Howard Lederer for $200,000, and he's going to go for the million this week.
Wow.
Instead of just saying, I'll take the $40,000 or I'll take the $200,000, he really wants his mother and his sister out because he's going for the million. I love it. And that was the best part about the show, is this guy is going for the million. And now you know I'm going to tune in this week to see if he does it. So,
all right, you know, it's hard to get your freak on when the mom's around. So, you know, more power to him.
Well, he's in the basement. I mean, you know.
You never know where she's going to come down and ask, you know, where he wants a snack or something, though.
It puts the lotion on.
But there's a great little discussion going on at AnnieUpMagazine.com/forum over this show. So check that out and chime in, and then we'll see whether folks have watched ESPN Inside Deal and what they think of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I got my Skype headset, which is optimized for Skype, but I also have it plugged into our phone jack, our hotline, 813-448-1120, and my caller ID here says Mark from San Diego is calling in, so let's see what he has to say.
I've got a request for you. Like a lot of your listeners probably do, I usually listen to the podcast when I'm driving to and from work. So when I'm trying not to crash my car, sometimes I'll forget what cards have come up when you're doing your hand of the week. So do you think you could, on every street, remind us of what cards are on the board? For example, Scott, you could say something like, the turn is the four of hearts, making the board the three of spades, ace of spades, ten of clubs, and the four of hearts. It sure would be appreciated by those of us who need to pay as much attention to our driving as we can. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Scott, what's the deal? Can you? You know, it's hard enough to get you to do the hand of the week, but we got to get you to repeat the cards.
I was going to say, I mean, this is obviously a new listener. who has not yet realized that I mangle the hand of the week consistently. Now he wants me to go back and remangle it on every street.
You know, it's weird, though. I did think that you were doing that lately, though. I thought you were making sure we knew what all the cards were. But, yeah.
Okay.
You know, but,
well, thank you, buddy.
But, you know, yeah, I'm standing up for you. Of course, I got your back, man. Anybody who can use the word solid successfully in the show, I've got his back. So, but really, you know, I do. And now, of course, with Lee Childs on board helping us with the hand of the week, I think that it's going to be even easier for you to remember to do all that and for him to make sure that we do that. So I'm really looking, and we got a lot of positive feedback on the hand of the week with him aboard.
Absolutely. So I will do my best, Mark from San Diego. And at the very least, what I can promise you is to send you a great piece of item off of the swag shelf. And I am going to send you this week, Mark, if you send me your address, a deck of the world's smallest playing cards.
Oh.
They're pretty cool. They're really tiny. And here's the thing, because, you know, Mark needs somebody to tell him the cards over and over. So just to spite you, Mark, I'm going to send you the smallest playing cards.
Well, here's the
so
thing,
you're
Mark.
You're trying to lay them out on the dashboard when you're driving. You're still not going to be able to see the cards.
Mark better appreciate this, Scott, I tell you, because, you know, here's the thing. You know, you leave anything at Scott's house, and he puts it on the swag shelf. I totally owned those decks of cards, and I left them there by accident, and now you're giving them away. I wanted those cards.
That's not true. That's not true. They are being regifted, but not from you, buddy.
Well, I wanted them. I was hoping to get those for Christmas from you.
Okay, well, maybe I'll put them in your stocking with your coal.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, well, Mark, send us your address. And anybody else wants to be on the hotline and win a wonderfully equal value gift, please call 813-448-1120.
Let me move on to the main mailbag here from Rob from Windsor. Now, I suppose Windsor is Canada?
Let's hope so, because that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever been up to Windsor?
I've never been to Windsor, but I've done the Windsor Wave.
Ah, the Windsor Wave.
Yes.
And actually, he does say Windsor, Ontario. But the Windsor Wave, what is that?
Oh, you don't know what the Windsor Wave is? Oh, my goodness.
Is that like a water slide?
No, it's the royal wave that they give when, you know, the queen or the prince or the king or whoever it is. It's the wave they give. It's sort of like the wrist rotates from left to right, and the hand is cupped, and it's the wave they give the paupers.
So you're
paupers.
Talking like the House of Windsor wave.
Yes, the Windsor
not
wave.
Not the Windsor, Ontario wave.
No, no. That's why I want to make sure he was from Canada, because if he's not, I'm doing the Windsor wave.
Okay. Well, I guess you could do it either way, because, you know. Oh, man. All right. But anyhow, he sent us a very detailed email that we will completely ignore. And boil it down to the essence of what he's asking for. Chris, he wants to know, what formula do you use to put people on a hand?
I use the Pythagorean theorem.
Excellent, I like that.
A squared plus B squared equals C squared. So I basically take the player's hands that I think they might be playing and square them, and then multiply them, and then divide them by the probability that I'll fold. And then I come up with ace king every time. So there's no formula. You're right. It's hard too because, you know, I think you have to think of how each player plays, and then or how this player. Or in other words, you know how like what's his name? Phil Hellmuth had like.
Oh yeah. Oh, what's his name?
Oh, what's his name? Phil Hellmuth. He had like animals that he would assign to particular types of players. Like the mouse would be the meek. Player and the elephant or whatever, you know, eagle would be the great Phil Hellmuth player or whatever they were.
So I would be the platypus.
Yeah, Scott's the platypus. So if you're going to put him on a hand, but really, it's not a formula. I just think that like if I would, what I would do is I put myself in a category and how I would play a hand, and then if that player plays something like me, then I would think, okay, what would I do in this situation?
Right.
Or how would I play it? And if they don't play like me, then I adjust off that. If they're really loose, then I have to open up the range of hands that they might play. But really, if you're put to a decision, you got to think about how he's playing it. You have to play the hand back in your head and just assign particular types of cards. You know, if there's two clubs out there, if you had a flush draw, would he have played it this way? If there are two straight cards, if he had a straight draw, would he have played it this way? That kind of thing. So I don't think it's a formula. I just think that you go over scenarios in your head, really. Isn't that what you do?
Well, I guess in a basic level, I have some sort of, a basic, if I know nothing about my player's formula, you know, obviously, you know, under the gun or under the gun plus one raises define a hand, and the raises from, you know, the button or the cutoff are a different range of hands. But then after that, then you've got to adjust it based off the player. So I guess that's what you're kind of saying as well, too. But I think there's kind of a base that you have to go off that, you know, generally speaking, people aren't going to raise with 3-4 offsuit under the gun.
Right.
So you can not eliminate, but at least make it much more less likely there. Unless Gus Hansen happens to be under the gun, and in which case, then you have to use what you know about him and adjust it accordingly. So I guess that's what I do.
Yeah, and I think that as the hand progresses, the more information you have and the easier it is to narrow possible
exactly.
hands down. I played this week at Tampa Bay Downs, the lovely Silks Poker Room, and I played in a little small cash game because I was there for the High Heels Poker event. Yes, I was wearing heels. And
and you looked fabulous.
And it looked fabulous, thank you. No, I was there covering it, but while it was going on, I said, well, I'll play some cash games. And there were a couple of players at the table where I just absolutely knew that they were drawing. By the way, they were calling instantly, and they continued to just call, you know, and you just knew that's what they had. So I just narrowed down their hands to probably the ace of hearts in their hand or whatever it was. And, you know, as the hand progresses, it's a lot easier to put someone on a hand. It's not easy to put them on a hand preflop unless they've done, like, the third raise, which TJ says, you know, third yeah. raise, re-raise, or whatever means kings or aces. So, yeah, always let the story tell you what's going on. That's the formula I use.
Very good, very good. All right, Rob from Windsor, we would love to send you a deck of Texas Hold'em strategy cards from GreatPokerHands.com. Thanks for sending that lovely letter in, and everybody else can send an email to us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and you too can be on the mailbag or the hand of the week and win some fabulous swag from the swag shelf.
Well, speaking of using a formula to put people on a hand, our one-minute mystery now has moved on. It's part three, and we're at level 4080, and we're under the gun plus one. So we raise 3x, which, of course, is 240 units, with a pair of jacks. The next player to our left calls, and we're heads up. Everyone else folds all the way. And we see a flop of queen of diamonds, seven of clubs, five of clubs. Our great detective checks and then calls our opponent's bet of 320. So now we see a turn of the six of clubs. So that's queen of diamonds, five of clubs, seven of clubs, six of clubs. And he wants to know what we would do. So, Scott, what would you do?
Well, you know me. I'm a weak, timid little mouse. That's what Phil Hummies calls me, you know. Every time we play together. But no, there's just way too many hands here that beat us. And I tell you, one of the big leaks in my game for a long time was playing pots out of position.
Yeah.
And I really worked on eliminating that. You know, to be a good player, you can't never play a pot out of position. But when you do play a pot out of position, I think it has to be on a situation where the chances of success are higher. And here... you know, we're looking at, there's an overcard on board, there's a flush on board now, and there's a straight on board right now.
Yeah.
And a lot of those things connect with the range of hands that our opponent could have. I just don't see any reason to try to be macho here and try to take down a pot. I am fine folding, and if it's the best hand, I'm still fine folding.
Well, speaking of mouse...
Check folding, I guess, you know, because we have... Don't have to fold out a turn yet.
Speaking of mouse, as Rat, my favorite 80s band, once crooned back in my favorite decade, lay it down.
Lay it down.
Oh, yeah. Check fold
lay
here.
Lay it down.
you got to check fold here. Like you said, look how many hands beat us. I mean, literally, we take the rest of the show just listing the hands
yeah,
that beat us
here. Exactly.
So I am definitely check folding. But the forum kind of thought it was pretty obvious, too. And only really one person, Rant, which is very close to Rat,
yes.
said check call, which is interesting. Maybe he doesn't believe him. And then he wants to see what the river brings. But we say check fold, and he says check call.
Yeah, if it's like a
I don't know, I guess what, a $40 bet's a minimum bet, you know, yeah. All right, you might suck me in for that, but, yeah, you know, yeah. If there's any more than that, forget it. So. Yeah.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to hear the result, and then he will continue with part four.
Welcome to episode four. If you recall last week, I folded my ace-queen, and now I checked a queen-high flop with my pocket jacks. When the turn comes a six of clubs, I've decided to lead out here. It's usually a mistake to take control of a hand back from an opponent after giving it up, and this mistake could cost me some chips, but I suspect he actually flopped top pair, and I want to know if he did. When I bet three quarters of the pot, he calls, and now I know he has top pair and is afraid of the flush board. The river's the nine of diamonds, and after I check, he confirms my suspicions by betting 640 into 3,000, a sure value bet. For some reason, curiosity got the best of me here, which is bad because it's too early to be calling for information. But I really wanted to see how the hand played out. I call the 640, and he shows queen of clubs, jack of clubs for top pair the whole way and made the flush. We were behind the whole way and would have lost the minimum had we had the discipline to fold.
Surprising, to say the least.
We're now fast-forwarding to the 5100 level, and note that due to a combination of bad play and bad luck, I've managed to turn 6K into 2.3K. But we never play as if we've given up. This hand fold. Mid-position calls. Hijack calls. Cutoff now raises it to 400. He has 5400 in chips. And after the button and small blindfold, action comes to me with six of clubs, five of clubs. Do you want to play this hand?
Remember, Sven, our friendly Poker Stars Porsche dealer? Sven's still very excited.
Yeah!
He already knows that Poker Stars players together earn enough VIP points to redeem five Porsches every day. What's made him a little more excited is the fact that five of our PokerStars players have already claimed these lovely pieces of German engineering. Keep Sven happy. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out why our rewards program seems to have left all the other schemes, well, stuck in neutral. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
Now, I want to apologize to the Annie Up Nation because you could not attend, well, it's sort of like an award show, you know, accepting on Scott's behalf. I had the pleasure, and I do mean pleasure, of interviewing the world champion from 1983, Tom McAvoy, a little while ago when he came to our state to play at the Palm Beach Princess Casino. He's good friends with the poker room manager there. He was in town to play a WPT satellite form and hang out and play and stuff. So I went over and got on the boat and played a little cash. And of course, you guys remember my terrible hand there, so and he couldn't save me from that, but he was a great interview, and we talked about a lot of stuff, including his bid to be in the Poker Hall of Fame, which we should know pretty soon whether or not he's going to make it or not. He's up against a tough field.
Yeah, absolutely.
So without further ado, I apologize again. Scott is not a part of this interview, but some lady keeps trying to be a part of it. You have to pay attention.
Excellent. Very good.
And we'll see how that goes.
Now, you have all kinds of poker milestones. Obviously, your four bracelets and your world title. But where does winning the first ever Binion's Cup rank in there?
It was probably next to winning the main event as far as the tournaments at the World Series, the second most important. The reason I say that is because I'm a candidate for the Hall of Fame this year.
Yes.
There's ten finalists, of which they'll probably choose two. And winning this tournament put me right back on the poker map. And since I've been around a long time, I've certainly established my credentials for longevity, which is one of the criteria. Showing that I can still compete at the very highest level, I think gives me a realistic shot of making it.
Now, you'll find out pretty soon, right? When do they let you know?
Well, there's three stages to the process. The nominations were allowed for the first time ever by the general poker public.
Yeah.
I actually campaigned, I have to admit.
Oh, okay.
I got about 1,300 Facebook friends. my girlfriend actually did it. She sent out a mass mailing.
Oh, my God.
Plus my own personal emails, and I talked to every one of my friends. I said, I not only want you to vote for me, get your friends to vote for me, and it doesn't matter if they play poker or not, just get some votes in. Anyways, it worked. Although I might have made it anyways, but
yeah.
I think I wound up as one of the highest vote getters.
Okay, so let's get back to the Binion's Cup. What are you going to do with the 1970 Corvette they gave you? What are your plans for that?
Well, my plan was very simple. I had an option. I could sell it and finance the rest of my tournament, or I could keep it, deal with the tax issues, and probably get a lot of speeding tickets and crash and kill myself. So I opted for the first.
Okay, so you sold it, okay.
I never actually drove it.
Now, I know that you had predicted ahead of time, or at least announced ahead of time, that you really wanted to win the Binion's Cup. Why was it so important to you? Was it just because of the Hall of Fame, or was it because, you know, you just wanted to show everybody that, hey, I'm Tom McAvoy, I've written all these books, I've won the World Series, I can play?
The Hall of Fame was, at the time, kind of in the background, but it was mainly because I didn't want to reestablish myself that I could play against the world's best players. And, I mean, there's 25 living World Series main event champions.
Right.
20 of us showed up. And where are you going to find a tougher lineup than that?
Yeah.
So,
if I could conquer that lineup, I think that kind of reestablished my credentials as a top player. You know, the old joke is those who can't play teach, and those who can't teach write books. You know? Well, I like to think that I can do all of the above and still play.
So I did
before the tournament started. I didn't necessarily predict I'd win. I said,
right,
there isn't one person here among the 20 of us that wants to win it more than I do.
Yeah, I remember now. That's what it was. And what I also wanted to ask you, too, is, you know, speaking of the World Series, as far as history, in terms of poker history, how significant was it to be the first World Series main event champion to come from a satellite?
Oh, I liked it. That wasn't the first year they did satellites.
Right. Be the first one to win from a satellite, right?
But yeah, my main concern back then was just getting in the tournament.
Yeah.
And I didn't care how I did it, just so I got in it, because that was my dream, to compete for the world championship. When I first moved to Las Vegas in 1979, I told some of my colleagues, I said, you wait and see. Within 5 years, I'll be playing in the World Series main event. They all laughed at me. I thought it was a big joke. I never said I'd win it.
Right.
I made it a year early. Because yeah, that was the first year I got in. It was the year I won it.
You might want to say this to the Hall of Fame voters, too, though. I mean, in a way, that win really could have contributed to, eventually, the boom, in the sense that, you know, a satellite winner, satellites became so important down the road, and that's how Moneymaker got in. I know a lot of people give him the credit, but really, satellites and you winning a satellite, that's a huge thing.
After that, satellites became more and more popular.
Yeah.
Once I could see that I was basically a 10-20 limit hold'em player.
Yeah.
And once I won, a lot of other people thought, well, you know, McAvoy can do it, I can do it, just like people felt the same way after Moneymaker won.
Right.
If he could get in and win, then they had a shot. And after Moneymaker won, the very next year, the attendance tripled.
Yes.
The year after that, it doubled again.
Yep.
Then it went up, not quite double, but up from over 5,000 to over like 8,700.
Yeah.
It's
remarkable.
Within 3 years, it went from 839 to 8,700. I mean, what in the world is this all about?
Hey, let me ask you now about, we talked about being a poker author, and you've written, I guess, is it 12 books now, or is it more than that?
I think it's 13.
13.
Now.
Did you write the Raz book? Is it out? I remember you talking about it once on Card Player TV.
Never wrote it.
You never wrote it?
Because the guy I was going to co-author with it, I told him, I said, there's no time frame on this. I don't want to spend a lot of my personal time on it, but I will add to it, critique it, and we have equal billing on the book.
Right.
But if for any reason you choose not to do it, then as far as I'm concerned, that's it.
Okay.
Well, I haven't heard from him in like 2 years now.
I'm a huge fan of Raz, and so are the people who are going to be listening to this interview. A lot of us, we actually had a slogan for our show called Let's Play Raz. We had little buttons made up. We really tried to start a resurgence with it, so we're real disappointed that your book didn't come out.
Yeah, I did write a section on Raz in my tournament poker book.
Yeah.
And I have a bracelet in Raz.
Right.
And I have three other top 10 finishes. I have like a 6th, a 7th, and a 9th in Raz at the World Series.
Yep.
And I've won Raz tournaments elsewhere. But, you know, it's... It would have died off, I think, almost completely if it wasn't for the horse games, because
right.
that's one of the games in horse.
Right.
And we used to make jokes about the Raz players, the average age is deceased. The old-timers game. No, but kind of like a low ball. But it's kind of resurgent. And I believe there is a Raz book out now that was written by some author that I never heard of.
Yeah, I think actually he's a listener to our show. His name's Mitchell Koger. He wrote a nice Raz book. It was really good, well received. He's got like a formula, not a formula, but something you can latch on to learn how to play the game, and then it takes it further than that. It's a pretty good book. But with all the writing that you do, does that keep you sharp as well? Do you feel like, because you write the column, you've written all the books, and I'm sure that there's probably revisions of the volumes and stuff, but does it help keep you sharp, your game sharp that way too, just always constantly writing about it?
Well, yeah, because you want to make sure that any information you put out is accurate.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's the same thing when I'm teaching people, either in a seminar or one-on-one. You know, when I teach or write, it makes me better because I want to make sure that I communicate effectively and accurately. So, yes, it does. By the way, people might be surprised to hear this, but I actually hate writing.
You hate writing.
I like the results.
Yeah.
But to actually sit down and get motivated. Once I start, get the first sentence out there, I'm okay. But it's very hard for me to motivate myself.
Wow.
And right now, it's funny because I'm fairly good at it from what I've heard. But right now, I'm probably not going to write more poker books. But I'll continue with my card player column.
Right. All right, so let me get into a little bit of the history of how you got started. You used to be an accountant, is that correct?
Yes.
And how did you actually get started
you
with poker?
You did your homework, didn't you?
Yeah, I try to make these interviews as thorough as possible.
I turned in my pencil in 1978. I got fired from my last accounting job on May 11th, 1978. I always remember that because that's like a milestone.
Wow.
Because the day I got fired, my boss said, "Tom, I couldn't have had a better accountant than you, but... I was not what you would call politically correct."
Oh, I didn't. No.
I'm a night person, and trying to fit me into a 9-to-5 role. I mean, and back then we'd also have home games on the weekend. Sometimes they start on a Friday night, wouldn't end till Sunday night. We played 2 days straight, so I wouldn't be too fresh come Monday morning.
Oh my God!
I also was. Office manager and had to supervise about a dozen women. Some of them had been with the company like before I was born. So when I wasn't their boss, I got along fine with them after I became their boss.
Yeah.
it didn't work. So a bunch of them kind of resented me. But my actual work performance was good. They come in there and I see no work on my desk. And you know why? Because I got rid of the papers. I just didn't pile up.
Yeah,
anymore.
yeah.
Like I wasn't doing anything, but I was.
So now what was the deciding factor? Is just because you lost your job, you said, "Hey, I do well in these home games, I'm going to give poker a shot," or was there something else?
There was something else. I had been subsidizing my income for several years off the poker.
Uh-huh.
And I also was very active in table tennis back then, and they had the National Table Tennis Championships at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. That started in 1976, and I didn't go that year, but the very next year, they had it right before Christmas, in December, so I decided, well, I want to go out there and play. So I did, and I was at Caesar's Palace, and lo and behold, I hadn't yet even played a hand of Texas Hold'em, but I played a lot of seven-card stud, and Caesar's Palace didn't have any Hold'em games, but they had seven-card stud games. So I was there 6 days, and I would spend most of my time either losing my matches because I was up all night from playing. I didn't lose them all.
Right.
But I wasn't as effective.
Congratulations, there are 3 jackpot winners.
Playing table tennis as I could have been.
Another $2,250 at machine number 5, and another $1,000 at machine number 6.
machine 151. You could be the next lucky winner. Good luck.
I want to strangle her, whoever that lady is. Slowly, watch her suffer. Anyway, I won about $1,000 in a week.
Wow.
Playing seven-card stud. Now, at the time, my salary was $18,000 a year, and the president of the company was making $50,000 a year. So, as I like to say, you do the math.
Yeah.
So that's... That really interested me. I said, well, wait a minute, maybe there's something here. So I said, well, I know what I'm going to do. The next time I get a vacation time, I'm going to go back and try it again. Well, before my vacation time kicked in, I got fired, and then they gave me like a month's severance pay, and I could get unemployment, you know, for 26 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So it took me a whole year to get that 26 weeks worth because I flew back and forth for a year, and every time I'm out of town, I had
to... Right, right.
So anyways, I flew back and forth from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I lived, to Las Vegas for a whole year. Sometimes the trips were a couple of weeks. Sometimes I stayed, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. And I knew this couldn't continue because I had a wife and three children. So I had to do one of two things. Go back to work as an accountant in Michigan, where I hated the weather.
Yeah.
Or follow my dream. And I told my wife I don't want to break up the family, I don't want a divorce or anything like that, but I have got to do this, and I'm going to either have to do it on my own, or what I want to do is, you know, sell the house and have the whole family move out there. And that's what we wound up doing. I timed it till the school year was out. So.
Right.
So I moved out to Vegas in July, the same weekend they opened Vegas World, which later became the Stratosphere Tower.
Yeah.
And, of course, I had three kids, three cats. U-Haul trailer that said Vegas or bust. No place to stay in the hottest part of the year. That was real fun. We had to sneak the cats in and out of the hotel. That's everywhere we went.
Oh, my God.
But I made it right from the start. I had already made up my mind that if I didn't make it as a poker player full-time, I'd just get a job somewhere because every business needs accountants,
yeah.
And I'd maybe play part-time. Well, that never happened. I never looked back. My own parents were alive at the time, thought I'd lost my sanity, as did all my other friends and relatives, and because that was not an acceptable profession by any stretch of the imagination, even though it was perfectly legal out in Las Vegas. So I had to kind of prove everybody wrong. I really didn't realize how much the deck is stacked against you. It's tough enough for a single guy just trying to struggle on his own, but I had all these other obligations.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but I made it. And they used to call Las Vegas, and still do for that matter, the graveyard of hometown poker champions. So if you could make it in Vegas as a player, you could make it anywhere.
Right.
Well, I made it right from the start. So my very first full year out there, I made about, I think, $27,000 or so. So I still made more than what I would have made as an accountant.
Right.
It was definitely something I just had to do. Yogi Berra said, if there's a fork in the road, which there was for me, take it. Two forks, I didn't say which one to take. So that was my fork in the road, and that changed my life.
Now, this doesn't really fit into where we were talking, but I know back in the 90s, you were a pretty heavy advocate for no smoking in the poker room. Is that right?
Big time.
How satisfying is it now to pretty much know that any poker room you walk into, there's no smoking and you can get that fresh air?
Well, let me put it this way. A guy came up to me at this last World Series, a guy I didn't even know. He says, Tom, I want to shake your hand and thank you for your greatest poker accomplishment. Do you know what it is? And I said, yes, I do. We're playing in a smoke-free environment at the World Series, which I helped get on. Now, I'm not saying I didn't have plenty of help or support, but at the time, I very briefly was involved with the World Series, and the Bainin clan, yeah. Not the Binions. I love Jack Binion, right. And I revered his father, Benny, the founder. But his sister and her husband were not the nicest people to work with.
Right.
But I took a job there as like card room manager, just so I could have an impact on the World Series.
Right.
And I talked their son, who was a smoker, I might add, into allowing World Series to go non-smoking for the first time. And that wasn't easy, but I did it.
Now, I still remember the old footage of Harrington with the little fan blowing the smoke away from Goldfarb when they're at the final table. What year was the first year in the series?
The first year in the series that was non-smoking was 2002.
Hey, this is AJ Benzing.
This is Justin Bonomo.
This is Downtown Chad Brown.
Hi, this is Clooney Gallen.
This is Daniel Negreanu.
Hey, this is David Singer.
This is Linda Johnson.
Hi, this is Greg Raymer.
Hi, this is Hoyt Corkins.
Hi, this is Cindy Violette.
Hi, this is John D'Agostino.
This is Joe Seabach.
This is Jennifer Harmon.
Yeah, this is Johnny Chan.
This is Cowboy Kenna James.
Hi, this is Mark Safe. This is Paul Wasikin.
Hi, this is Miami Johnson, Italy.
This is Doyle Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
Chris, our good buddy Lee Childs is back already.
Must be a hold'em hand.
Good point. We've talked to our boy Lee, and he can't play those crazy carnival games that we like to play here on Annie Up. So as long as it's no limit, Texas Hold'em.
It's hard for me to handle more than two cards at once. Don't know what to do.
All right, so we're my folks from last week, Lee Childs from AcumenPoker.net, and he's going to be coming around every once in a while, as long as we leave a cup of milk outside Annie Up headquarters. Stop by and lap it up a little bit and share some advice. And so we're ready here. We got another No Limit Hold'em Cash game online at thewonderfulpokerstars.com. And once again, micro limits.
Yes.
Right down where Lee likes to hang. This
right
is
on.
A nickel dime cash game hand online. Comes to us from Mike Jacobs, all the way from Columbus, Georgia. Goes by Mustang Mike J online. I think he's got a rap career ahead of him. all right, so it's a, like I said, nickel dime. Our hero has $7.45 in chips. And believe it or not, he is the short stack at this table that looks like most people have about 10 or 11 bucks in front of him.
That's not uncommon.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not uncommon.
Yeah, and this is something that it brings up a good point, which is especially easy to do online. You know, when you're playing in these games, you should really try to have 100 big blinds in front of you. You know, you want to have those situations, unless you feel like you're one of the more inferior players at the table. You want to have as much as you can on the table, so that if you get the right situations, you're going to get full value out of your hands. Of course, this means you are risking more when you have an inferior hand, but hopefully, as everybody gets better and better, they're going to be in more situations where they're able to maximize the value on those hands. So I like to use the auto top-up feature when I'm playing cash games online. So even after I post a blind, I'm right back to 100 big blinds.
Well, that brings an interesting point, because when you play live, you don't do that. When you play live cash games, unless you're down to a certain amount, most people just sit there and, okay, I got $85 now on my $100 buy-in. You're not going to buy $15 worth of chips. So,
I do.
But most people don't do that. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember the last time that's happened ever at a cash game where guys will do it like when they get down to, $20, they'll buy 80 more or whatever. But I never see a guy hand over $15 to the dealer and say, give me $15 in chips. I mean, it almost never happens.
Yeah, it is rare, and it's a mistake, because when you don't do that, then you're limiting what you can play profitably pre-flop. You're limiting your flexibility there. In fact, if I'm playing in a game that has a no cap on it and somebody happens to win a monster pot, I'll even if I have 100 big blinds or 200 big blinds, if all of a sudden they've got 300 big blinds, I'm loading up.
Awesome.
So I want to if it's possible, I want to have the biggest stack covered.
Makes sense to me. All right, so the hand starts with the under-the-gun calling. We got a couple of folders, a couple callers, the button folds, small blind calls. So one, two, three, four players in. We are in the big blind, king of diamonds, king of hearts. Wow us once again, Lee.
I'm going to raise to about 70 cents right here. with all of these limpers, assuming our standard raise is three big blinds, whatever our standard has been at the table, if it's three or four big blinds, I'm going to raise it that amount plus account for each of these limpers. And that's regardless of whether I have two kings here, two jacks, you know, two aces, whether I had nothing and was just making some kind of squeeze play, which I don't need to make in cash games very often. But I'm going to make it at least 60, probably, you know, 60, 65, 70 cents somewhere in that neighborhood.
All right. So you're saying that the traditional raise here would be 30 cents. And since there's four colors at a dime each, you're adding that total to the raise to make it 70 cents. That's what you're saying, right?
That's right.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Our hero goes the standard route, raises 30 cents all the way up to 40 cents. Under the gun gets out of the way, but the two middle position callers will stick around, and the small blind gets out of the way. So we're three-handed. We see a flop of six of clubs, eight of diamonds, queen of clubs.
It's a pretty good flop.
And we are first to act.
And I'm gonna bet about a dollar here. Chris, what would you do? You got $1.40 in the pot there?
Yeah, I would definitely bet about three-quarters of the pot. So I would bet maybe $1, $1.10, something like that.
Yeah, I think right either one of those is fine. I'm not going to bet the pot because I'm scared of a flush draw or anything like that. I want to be consistent with my flop size bets. If somebody has any kind of draw, just by betting two-thirds to three-quarters of the pot, you're always pricing them out. So if they happen to call, they're making a mistake. So all you need, I mean, even if you bet half the pot, you're pricing them out with just the turn card to come. So anywhere between half and a full-size pot bet is fine. And so I like to be consistent and stay right around two-thirds. So I'm betting a buck here.
Yeah, I agree. $1, $1.10, something like that.
Yep.
Well, this is going to be a very boring hand of the week then because our hero bets $1. Dialed in. He gets one folder, but one caller. So we're heads up now, going to the turn. That's a four of spades, making the board six of clubs, eight of diamonds, queen of clubs, four of spades. Can't believe that we're scared at all by this card, but prove me wrongly.
No, I mean, I'm not scared by the card. I think it's important to think about, like, right when we make that bet and he calls, we have a guy who's limped in, and then he's just called here. So this is where we need to start narrowing down his range. For me, it's against most players, it's unlikely that it's a queen because a queen is going to raise because of the two clubs. Because, again, people are usually just scared of flush draws.
Right.
And, you know, even though we're the pre-flop aggressor, you know, sure, we could have ace-king of clubs or something like that. So any queen is likely to raise, any set is likely to raise. Those hands should raise in those spots and not just call and let us dictate what kind of price we want to play for if we're on a draw. So I think this guy is on some type of draw himself, whether it's a straight draw or flush draw. And so we could already see that if those are his hands, unless he specifically has like 5-7 of clubs or 9-7 of clubs, where he's open-ended with the flush draw. If he just has a flush draw or a straight draw, then we already have gotten him to make a mistake in this hand. So that's good, and it's important to remember that even if he were to get there, that's okay, because we're already making him pay the wrong price to draw there.
I have to say something here. I think it's very important to know where this player was when he called preflop raise for me to know what kind of hand he has. And the reason why I say that is if he was the fourth person to call a 30-cent raise, he could easily have 7-9 suited.
Yep.
But if he's the first person to call a raise, then he's probably got... In this situation, he might have something like Queen-Jack or something. So I need to know where he was when he called and if he was calling with, like, 5-1 on his money or if he was calling with, like, 2-1 on his money. So I need to know that before I can say or narrow down what I think he has. Scott, do you know where you see it?
Yeah, that's a good point. He was in the cutoff position.
All right. Yeah, so that that's means,
a. Yeah. Sorry, that's a fantastic point, Chris. That was that.
He gets one good. Once a year. Lee.
Once a year, baby.
I know. Amazing, but that's something good that I left out there. Yeah, he's in the cutoff, so he was the third one to call there.
Yeah. So I mean, I now as far as the way he smooth called there, not smooth called, because that would indicate when I say that it means a big hand. I have no idea what he has, but he could have connectors now. Then you know, and if he has connectors, I mean, he could have. I guess he could have 9-10, I mean, or something like that, but that would still be a gut shot, but a double belly buster
at
9-10. So he could have 9-10 or 7-9. I mean, you don't know. With those kind of odds, he could be calling with that, and it's still a very small game. I mean, I understand we talked about last week where we had said, you know, you still have to play by the rules despite how little the money is, but guys are willing to take chances with connectors like that, I think, especially when they're getting 5 or 6 to 1 on their money. So
sure.
I can't put him on ace queen here. I got to put him on something like 9-10 or 7-9 right now. If I had to put him on a hand, that's what I would do.
Yeah, even 5-7, and that's another good point. Wow, two in a row, this is amazing. But you know, my point of that he's made a mistake, that's not going to matter to most people. Most, you know, your average player, they play a hand, drawing type of hand to hit their draw or to just nail it. So they're not going away based on the bets. And, you know, if I had a hand like 5-7, 9-7, or 9-10, which are all effectively the same hand here being open-ended, since the double belly buster is really the same thing, then since he wasn't getting the right price to just draw there, unless he has two clubs in his hand along with those cards, then he should be raising in that spot.
Yeah.
And just trying to create the fold out of Mike there. But, you know, you're going to find more often than not people, you know, flopping some type of draw, and then they're just going to draw to it. Now, keep in mind also, if he doesn't have two clubs in his hand and he just has those cards, the 5-7, 9-7, or 9-10 with no clubs, then he's really only looking at like 6 outs.
Right.
That he can count on as being pure outs. So it would be even more of a mistake just to flat there.
All right, well, I think that was a good discussion there, and I think, you know, if we're right, then the only hand at this point that we're scared about right at this immediate moment is 5-7 when the four of spades came. So do we bet big here and really discourage him drawing any further?
I'm betting the same percentage that I would. I don't want to discourage him from continuing if he's on a draw. I just want to make him pay the wrong price if he's on a draw. So I want to bet like, you know, anywhere, you know, 210, 220, 230, somewhere in that neighborhood with $3.40 in the pot. You know, I think 220 is a perfect bet here. With one card to come, if he's got either one of those draws, he's getting way the wrong price to draw at this point.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking 250 or something, 230. So, yeah, I agree. That's how much I would bet. I mean, unless I was 100% positive this guy's got, like, a monster draw, yeah, that's what I would bet, too.
So, you know, if the guy has the flush draw, right, then he's got 9 outs. He's essentially 4-1. So anything that you bet over that is getting him to make a mistake. And it's a lot of people make mistakes when they're scared somebody's on a draw that they want to bet to keep them off the draw, so they want to bet big, so they might bet the pot here to discourage the draw. But what you really want to do is just make a bet size that so that the pot is laying them the incorrect odds to make their draw. You know, it doesn't change the fact that they're going to usually call, and if they get there, they get there. That's a long-term win for you. You have to look at it that way. And also, if you bet the pot, they're probably still going to call, so they're still going to get there. So then you're just losing even more when they do get there.
Right.
Right? So you just want to keep those bet sizes consistent. And as long as you're sticking around 2/3 of the pot, you're going to price out all of those draws unless they have the combo draw where, like, say, on the flop, he would have been a favorite with his 15 outs if he had a, you know, flush and straight draw. So just, you know, and you can't price that draw out because he's favored.
Excellent. All right, well, our hero bets out $1.80, so a little less than he probably should have. And he is just called by his opponent, which I think proves that we're against a draw then.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah, he's got to be a draw if he had a set or if he even made his straight. Like I feel like 5-7's out of the picture in most cases at this point because the 5-7 is usually going to come alive unless he had the 5-7 of clubs. So you're it's still, we didn't mention this before, but it could have been an 8 before or even like 2 jacks, 2 tens. 2-9, something like that. We should have been, you know, more inclusive of those ranges. I mean, those are hands that would call on the flop, but at this point, I think they're either going to give up or they're going to try to raise and think that we might be on a flush draw. So when he just calls here, those hands are still possible. So let's not rule them out. But any pair between 8 and queen is also still a possibility here.
Yeah.
But most likely it's the draw.
Okay. We go to the river, which is the 10 of diamonds, which gives us a board of 6 of clubs, 8 of diamonds, queen of clubs, 4 of spades, 10 of diamonds. I'm going to go out on a limb and say we may not be ecstatic about this card.
Yeah, I don't love it, but, you know, it's 7-9 is the only one that got there, 2 tens.
Jack 9 of clubs got there, too.
I'm sorry, yeah, Jack 9 of clubs. That's a good one that we didn't really talk about. There's a lot of hands that could be beating us. Queen 10 could have just been calling. A lot of people don't raise to protect, and even though I think the majority of the people would want to raise to protect or to, quote, find out where they're at with their queen. So a queen 10 type of hand is possible here, too.
Well, let me ask you now. Let's say you did put him on 9-10. And now he's got a pair of 10s. You're not thinking value bet here, right? You're just happy to get away with this pot if you can win it at all.
Yeah, I'm hoping 9-10 was the hand because I don't want a value bet. At this point, I think there's more hands that can beat me than don't beat me here. The 9-10, we may check call a bet here. And hope that it's something like 9-10 that thinks we were on a flush draw and now they're trying to get value. But your Jack 9 got there, your 7-9 got there, your Queen 10 got there. I mean, heck, even an 8-10 is still a possibility. If he had 2 10s, he's now got a set. I think if, you know, the only way we're ahead here is if it was just a queen played really passively and we could check call and get value from them. And it could be that 9-10 type of hand, or the 9-10 that may try to now think that they're good and bet. But I mean, the worst thing would be to bet and get raised. I just don't think we're getting value from any of the hands that we beat by making a bet here. But I'm willing to check call. I still, you know, I mean, if I check and he just jams, I might just let it go. But I'd probably check call a reasonable size bet if it looked like a value bet. Or if he jams, it might look like a bluff of a missed flush draw. So I just have to know with my opponent. But I'm certainly going to check and then evaluate the bet size and see if I can figure out what he's trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, Lee. If you check here, I know a lot of players are going to jam with a lot of hands because they feel that you're going to. That's the way to win it. If you don't have a history with this player, what makes your decision on whether you call that jam?
Just if it seems reasonable. I think most of the time, people make smaller value bets, right? And then they make bigger bets when they're bluffing. Which is why the opposite sometimes works in your advantage, right? You make a smaller bet when you're bluffing, and you make the oversized bet when you have the nuts. So the river is the time that I do vary my bet sizes to try to, you know, influence or deceive my opponents in the way that I want to. So in this case, with, you know, if I had a busted flush and I wanted to take a shot at winning the pot, and Mike checked to me, I would err on the side of making a small bet to make it look like a value bet. Whereas if I had Jack 9 offsuit so that he thinks maybe I had a busted flush, maybe I had Jack 9 of spades here, or if I had the Jack Nine of clubs, like this is perfect. Actually, my favorite draws are the flush draws with the gut shots, because if the gut shot gets there, that's not the club in this case, then it's so much more hidden. Right. So with a hand like Jack Nine of clubs, if it got checked to me, I would definitely put Mike all in. And it's actually a reasonable size bet. Mike only has $425 left. There's $7 in the pot. But if I had Jack Nine of clubs and it was checked to me, then I would actually move all in. I wouldn't even bet like $4 or $425 that Mike has left. I would move all in to make it look like I don't want to call.
Right.
And then I'm going to bet smaller if I'm trying to bluff at it. But I think I just check here and try to evaluate it and then just, you know, trust my, you know, my experience as far as what the bet size means. It's going to be hard for me to fold here too, but I don't know that there's many hands. The other, you could do like a weak lead, but if you move all in here, you're only getting called by hands that beat you. I think I don't think the queen is calling you or just an eight is calling you at this point.
Okay, well, our hero bets out $2.70, and he's called by his opponent, who flips up nine of hearts, seven of hearts,
wow.
Straight to the 10.
Wow.
Well,
now, what I want to talk about, what I want to talk about here is, I mean, obviously, I think what we've already talked about, that Mike's bet probably wasn't the correct move here. But what about our opponent who just calls? I mean, he's got, what, the second nuts here?
Yeah, I think, well, here's the thing. I can defend Mike's bet a little bit because I've made some funky bets like this where people will fold, you know, some of these types of hands that have me beat. You know, maybe just a low two pair. Like maybe if the guy had like 8-4 or 6-8. He now folds to this bet because it looks like such a value bet, and it saves Mike $1.55. Like if Dustman comes over the top, then I would throw away my kings and save that $1.55. And a lot of people would say, "Well, I'm committed here," but the thing is, he typically can't raise you here without a hand better than your one pair. And then, you know, it's important to keep in mind, you've only got one pair at showdown or at the river, and one pair is just generally not good. The fact that you're against one opponent makes it more likely good, but not the way this played out. So this is another option to make this small little value-looking bet that Mike made here, but he would have to fold if the guy comes over the top. So that's not that bad. The guy just calling with the 9-7 there, I think, is pretty awful. Like, my chips are getting in the middle. If you're afraid for some reason that Mike raised after all these limpers with Jack 9, you know, I mean, it's not going to be there, you know, and you're just hoping that Mike had two queens the whole time and is trying to get value out of his flop set or his two eights or something like that. But if you play this hand like 9-7, you pay the wrong price the whole time getting there. And then you finally get there, and then don't try to get that extra value. That's a big mistake.
Yeah, there's just no way Mike has Jack 9 the way he played it. There's just no way. It's just a terrible, terrible call.
Yeah, I mean, he made bad calls the whole way. His preflop call is fine. I love his preflop call with the raise, and then, as you know, then somebody else calls, and it's only like 3% of his stack to make this call with the 9-7 in position. But on the flop, he gets the wrong price. On the turn, he gets the wrong price. And then on the river, you know, if you're ever paying the wrong price, the reason you're doing that is for the implied odds of stacking your opponent.
Exactly.
And so you really want to maximize that when you get there. And that was actually the perfect, just about the most perfect river card for him. And one that will typically get kings to pay you off, especially if they've already led into you for 270 over half their remaining stack. They're probably going to pay that off. But I would, if I led here and I was Mike, I would definitely fold once he shoves like he should. the call's pretty bad.
Well, Mike, you didn't win the pot, but you do win a lovely card protector from PokerFaces.tv. Well worth more than the $11.60 that your weak opponent took from you. So enjoy that. We'll send that out to you. And Lee, as always, it's nice to have you stop by the headquarters and wow us with your knowledge of poker.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. And the milk was awesome.
I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
And we'll see you at the table.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
So how ticked off do you get when somebody calls it ping pong?
Ping pong is something you play in your basement. Table tennis is what I used to play.